I often like to say the stool on which good aging sits is has three legs, and the three legs are, you know, physical activity, good nutrition, and then social connectivity and a sense of purpose in life. And, you know, one of those legs is a little bit wobbly, the stool's hard to sit on, and if you've only got one, then, you know, you really, the stool's going to fall over.
What is up, my friend, and welcome back to the show. So excited to have you here today. Got a great episode for you on longevity, on the key to aging well, on the key to not just having a long lifespan, but a long health span so you can enjoy the things that you love to do, spending time with your family, traveling around the world, doing extreme sports like kite surfing, whatever it is that you're into, walking up the stairs without holding on to dear life for the handrail. And in case you're tuning in for the first time, I'm health expert Ted Rice, coach to entrepreneurs, executives, and other high-performing professionals, and you're listening to the Legendary Live podcast. What we do here is we break down science-based information on how to lose fat, prevent disease, and live a longer, healthier life. And if that sounds good to you, if you're interested, if I've got your attention, what I want you to do is go to legendarylifepodcast.com/review, where I show you how to subscribe to our podcast. So that way, whenever my interviews with experts, one of my solo episodes, or one of my Real Talk Fridays comes out, you'll be the first to know. And today, I've got a special guest for you, but before I do that, if you've been listening for a while and haven't left us a review, please, again, go to legendarylifepodcast.com/review and leave us a review. We read all the reviews. We want to know what you think. We want to hear your feedback, and we want to grow. We've got a team now. We've got Vilmas, who's our VA. We've got Stan doing the audio editing. We've got Honeyzel doing the show notes. We all want to hear from you. We want to make this the best podcast you've ever listened to because it changes your life. That is the standard that we have. So on that note, make sure you listen to my Real Talk Friday episodes as well. If you're, I'm coming to you from the Mayan Riviera is what I'm trying to say. And I've been having a lot of adventures, doing a lot of growth, having a lot of experiences. So make sure you listen to those Real Talk Fridays if you want to hear what's going on with me personally. But if you're here for the interviews, that's cool too. We've got a great one for you today. His name, today's guest's name is Stuart Phillips. He's a professor in the Department of Kinesiology and School of Medicine at McMaster University in Canada. He is the guy. If you want to know, you hear so many people talking about longevity, talking about the best things to do to live a long time, what really matters when it comes to health. But this is the guy that actually does research on it. In fact, he's authored more than 300 research papers on topics in human physiology, nutrition, and aging. He is the real deal, my friends, and I'm so excited to bring this episode to you. So without further ado, we're going to get into the foods that are worth eating and why nutrient density is a cornerstone of health, why protein is important in aging, why exercise is the key to aging well, why resistance exercise should be a keystone activity in your life, and the importance of staying socially connected and its connection with longevity. You're going to learn a lot. Hope you enjoy it. Let's step into the interview with Dr. Stuart Phillips. Stu Phillips, thanks so much for coming back on the show. Really excited about our conversation today. It's been a couple years, I think. I thought it was only one, but it looks like it was more like 2 years since we've spoken last. And we're going to get into aging, how to do it well. You've outlined some great things that we're going to get into. And man, just really excited to dive into it with you.
Well, thanks for having me on, Ted. I appreciate it. It's always good to have a chat for sure.
Yeah. And let's just hit the ground running so you and I were talking, it's September 11th today, and it's 2020. The whole coronavirus has, we were just talking about it before we started recording. One of the things it's done is it's put people's health into perspective.
people are more interested in like, hey, what are the best things to do? And there's so much misinformation out there that it's very difficult to sift through. So today we're going to go over nutrient density, something that you wanted to talk about today. We're going to go over why protein is important in aging. We're going to talk about exercise, specifically resistance exercise as a keystone activity, and why, and I love this part, staying socially connected is important. So before we get into it, how did you get into the anti-aging, if for lack of a better term, or aging well? How did you get into this particular area of inquiry, area of expertise?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, I think for a lot of people, particularly who are in human physiology and human nutrition as we are, at some point the research becomes me search. And I sort of use that term to say, you know, I'm getting older. And so I'm obviously interested in some of the things that would allow me to age well. But the picture really came into focus for me about 5 years ago when I assumed the directorship of what's called the Physical Activity Center of Excellence at McMaster. And that's, you know, it's a program actually that's been ongoing for almost 40 years in various forms. And I would walk through a gym just about every day that was populated by community members who were undergoing things like cardiac rehabilitation. We offer services for people with spinal cord injuries, with multiple sclerosis, cancer patients, for example. And I would just sort of assume that that's what a lot of people did. And then when I really looked at some of the data out there, actually, you know, as you know, most people aren't physically active. And yet, you know, here I was talking about how good it was for people as they got older. And then when I became the director of that center, it really just brought the picture into focus. I would run into people on a daily basis that would tell me, you know, how they had come to be physically active later in life, but what it really meant to them and what it did for them. And it just struck me as something that, you know, if the message wasn't out to them earlier in life, then it really needed to be promoted a lot sooner. And, you know, a lot of us talk about it. And, you know, I'm probably preaching to the converted, clearly, probably in your audience too. But I think it's, you know, as one of these, as I said, you know, cornerstone activities of aging, I don't think there's a single lifestyle related change you can make in your life that would have an all-encompassing benefit in so many dimensions as to be physically active. So it's something that's become a sort of a mission of mine, so to speak. So, you know, walk the walk and or talk the talk for a long time, obviously been walking the walk, but now it's about talking the talk to others and trying to get them to buy into the message.
I want to dive into that, especially how much to do. What does it mean to be physically active? I've gone over the government guidelines, both the US and the Canadian. So it'll be fun to kind of talk about that. And what is there an upper limit, a point of diminishing returns? Before we do, one of the things that you said is we're all aging and most of us will live longer than our parents and our kids will live longer than us. But nobody wants to live to 120 and feel 120 or spend the last 10 to 20% of their life in sickness. Couple things here. Obviously, I mean, what you said is just, we all feel that way. But I had Charles Brenner, who is another guy who's considered an anti-aging expert, did a lot of the research on NAD, a supplement I'm sure you're familiar with. And what he said and what I hear you saying is that 120 seems to be like this maximum lifespan of a human being. Can you talk a little bit about that? Why is it 120?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I actually had a sort of pseudo conversation. I might call them pseudo conversations on Twitter, where you exchange some comments with somebody. And you know, this person was sort of saying is that degenerative aging is a myth. And, you know, aging's not a myth. Everything ages. And, you know, if you're a fruit fly all the way up to human beings, everything ages. And, you know, there's probably
about five or six chief theories as to what aging is all about and what is it that goes wrong with increasing age of any organism. It doesn't matter. The degenerative part, I would argue, is the part of the modification. And clearly the difference is what we're talking about is not just lifespan, but about health span. Right, like as I said, I think it's laudable to aim for about 120. I think whatever theory of aging it is that you subscribe to, it seems that 120 years is the sort of outer envelope beyond which whichever theory you subscribe to, things just degrade. The whole system just sort of, you know, comes apart and loses the wheels, so to speak. But even if it's not, if you want to live to be, you know, and it's fantastic. You know, I always use this gentleman as an example. We have one participant in PACE, and he's 102. And I say he moves like a 78-year-old, and that may not sound great, but if you're 102, it's pretty good. And he just, you know, I think he's sort of one of these super aging people that he's got a great set of genes, he's maximized his chances, et cetera, et cetera. And he's doing really, really well. But who wants to be 102 and feel like you're 102? He says he feels good. My guess is probably like a lot of these super agers, so-called, at some point they just drop off and that's the way things go. But, you know, I think for most people, they'd like to live well up until the point where they die and not spend it in sickness. Activity, physical activity, diet, and then the social connectivity, I think, are these sort of three cornerstones of doing that and doing it well.
Now, why not the nutrient density?
Yeah, the nutrient density piece is something, you know, and I sort of talk about it in the context of the real food, whole food type approach. And, you know, I clearly, like you, if you've had Charles Brenner on, you would have heard a lot about NAD and a lot of other sort of supplements that could prolong that. And there's plenty of them coming out. I think from a dietary perspective, whole foods are still the way to go with respect to maximizing the amount of nutrients that you're going to get. And we talk about protein foods, obviously, in my lab more than anything else, and about the nutrient-dense package that they provide. More so animal-based proteins than plant-based proteins, although I'm not naive enough to say the mixture is probably better, I think, than one or the other. But if you've only got you know, a 2,000-calorie budget in a day, and that's covering your energy expenditure to get all the nutrients that you need without having to rely on supplemental ways of getting them, then the increasing nutrient density of the foods you consume becomes important. So are you getting enough iron, B12, zinc, all of the micronutrients that, you know, we probably don't know enough about to say this is going to support good, healthy, active aging? And, you know, at the optimal level, and a lot of people then subscribe to sort of overdoing it, and I'm not sure that's good either. It sort of seems there's this fine balance between getting what you need, maybe getting an optimal level that maybe where it's a lot harder to peg what that is, but then there's sort of supra optimal, and I don't think that, you know, some nutrients you just shouldn't go there. But doing it with protein-based products and more so animal-based protein products is an easier way than trying to sort of pick your way around which foods that you might want to eat, for example.
Yeah, you have a PhD. You are a person who's the director of this activity center. You speak with a lot of other extremely knowledgeable experts. One of the things that I think it's frustrating for people on the other side listening to this is like, well, tell me the superfood to eat. Is it, should I be having spirulina and eating the blueberries? Like, is that going to make a difference for me? Is it, what are the superfoods that are going to maximize like my chances of living a long time, but living well and preventing disease? And there's a lot of people who say the exact opposite of you. Obviously, their background is more marketing than actual science. But can you talk a little bit about like, well, are there specific foods that you think, hey, listen, look, you should, obviously, Stu, I'm sure you and I are in agreement on this, in that whatever you choose to do, it's got to fit what you actually can do. It's got to fit your budget. You don't want to have to order foods from some place that it takes weeks to deliver or whatever. It needs to be something that you can add into your life and do. And but what would be the foods that you would choose that say, hey, listen, these foods have a lot of research or at least potential with what we know about the nutrition evidence, the nutrition research. Like, these are the things that you should eat if you want to, you know, keep your brain healthy, keep your cardiovascular system healthy, maybe fight off cancer. What would you say?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you could pick and choose specific foods. I'm not sure I subscribe to the viewpoint that there's a superfood, that there's one thing that is going to be, you know, so superior to something else. But I think when you look at it sort of in totality, and instead of sort of isolating specific foods, it still is the broadness in terms of the nature of human evolution that I think when you look at the, again, you got to take the big picture view, is going to give you the best chances. So it's clear to me that darkly pigmented vegetables and fruits, for example, have antioxidants and lots of probably other phytonutrients that we have no idea how they're working. And it's probably true that the matrix of the food itself may enhance some of these actions. But it may be, to Charles Brenner and a point about some of these nutrients. And there's one I'm familiar with called urolithin, which is, you know, from pomegranate seeds, for example, that you might have to purify to get some sort of benefit from. So, you know, I think it's a variety of foods. It's fruits and vegetables, no doubt. They have to be part of it. And I know there's a raging debate. Fruits aren't necessary, whatever. I mean, the point I would make is that something that's lost in this conversation is still around the enjoyment aspect of food. And so honing in on the, you know, the functionality of food and then only picking and choosing green spirulina milkshakes or whatever it is, or, you know, maybe milk is going to kill you as well, seems to me to be an odd way to choose. So I still think about the sort of social aspect of food that is important. Obviously, our work deals with protein. I think that that's important as you get older to consume more than the RDA, for example, at 0.8 grams per kilo per day. So we think about twice that amount. But the overriding message, and one that I've sort of begun to push, and I really believe this, is that physical activity or you know, planned exercise is a forgiver of many sins, and which is not to say that, you know, you can outrun the bad diet. You know, if you have a bad diet, you got to do a lot of exercise, and the older you get, you have to do more to outrun it. But it really does in any circumstance, and it doesn't matter, you know, you name, even if you're a smoker, which is, you know, certainly a prescription for a shorter lifespan and health span, and you're physically active, and I get it, there's not too many of them, you live longer and you live better. So, you know, for something that powerful to overcome probably, you know, as we know it, the most powerful carcinogenic activity that you could undertake on a regular basis that, you know, is legal just about everywhere in cigarette smoking, it's got to be pretty powerful. So, you know, to me, activity is at one corner, foods are at the other corner, and you can draw lines and you can argue, you know, which sits on top of what. But I would argue that you could be physically active and not have the best diet and still live as well and as long as somebody who has the best diet but is physically inactive.
I want to, like I said earlier, dive into that and what does it mean to be physically active and what's optimal for sure. Although I know there isn't a clear answer, but at least we can maybe get guidelines to get ourselves in the ballpark. What would you say about, because I've talked to Alan Aragon a lot, who, you know, we both are familiar with, and, he was talking about, hey, as long as you're covering your bases nutritionally and staying lean, we're living in an environment where there's a lot of hyper palatable foods. And for those of you who are listening, and if that's a new term, what we're talking about is refined foods that are a combination of not just carbs, but carbs and fat. For example, ice cream. If you like Häagen-Dazs, look on the calories coming from fat. It's more calories coming from fat than from sugar. And so we have these things that are in our environment. Croissants, it's not just carbs, it's buttery bread, right? Delicious. But what do we know about the effects of these processed, these hyper-palatable foods, other than the fact that they're nutritionally not the best, even though arguably the flour that's used, at least in the examples, you know, in the bread examples, and then the milk in the ice cream examples, like there's nutrients there. What would you say about the hyperpalatable foods? What is your perspective on the more processed foods and their effect on longevity?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. And the so-called hyperpalatability aspect of foods is really, I think a lot of people would probably agree, and you know, Alan would probably make this point as well, or anybody, when you're talking to somebody about foods to eat and foods, say, not to eat, and it's almost universal, at least in North America, but even having gone to supermarkets in Europe and Australia and everywhere, is that around the outside of the supermarket, there's produce down one aisle, there's meats, and there's probably dairy down the back aisle there somewhere. That if you only ever spent your time pushing your cart up and down there and loading up with those products, you would be okay. Clearly, the processing of flour, as an example, the removal of the whole grain, not whole wheat, but whole grain, has, you know, done us a disservice. So anything that's processed to usually enhance its shelf life, but the middle of the grocery store where all of these hyper-palatable foods, where, you know, we have 1,000+ new foods introduced every year, you know, things that didn't exist last year, are designed to deliver nutrients in most cases cheaply. And that means usually higher sugar or higher fat or saturated fat. And are given a taste profile that involves usually blends of sweetness and salt, sometimes together, that have a characteristic that people who, you know, come up with these foods, that makes them moorish. So the more you eat, the more you want to eat. And, you know, potato chips are a great example. People, it's sort of all of a sudden, and usually a mindless activity while you're watching television, you'll look down, you'll be like, holy cow, how come I ate, you know, 2/3 of a bag? And it wasn't the small bag that you had, you know, 10, 15 years ago. All of a sudden, the bag's bigger. And all of those things probably play into the environment that we're in. I think it would be fair to say, and I'm not into sort of diet wars, but you know, if you had the vegans at one end and the carnivores at the other, and these are diets that people find, A, I can eat them, B, I find my health is good, and I don't want to get into which is better, but I'm going to obviously have my own bias. I eat vegetables, but I also eat meat. So the, you know, Michael Pollan's omnivore's dilemma is to avoid the middle of the grocery store. And that's where the battle lines really should be drawn around, you know, Twinkies and cakes and crackers and hyper, as you said, processed, but also hyper palatable foods that just, they're very nutrient poor for the most part, not always, but for a large part, but energy dense. And so, you know, it's this sort of sugary, fatty, salty, and yet not very many other nutrients in them, foods that are in the middle of the grocery store where you want to try and spend less time.
Solid advice. When we started this conversation about nutrition, and I'm going to move on from it soon, I promise, right? But one more question, because I'm super curious about your perspective. But you said, okay, well, there's, you know, getting an adequate amount of nutrients, and then there's optimal, and then there's super optimal, which turns out not to be optimal, right? In the case of, you know, zinc or vitamin D comes to mind, right? Once you pass a certain threshold, it seems, and I'm no expert, so feel free to correct me if I'm mistaken about this, but it starts causing other risks. How would we know what is the best? Let me start off by saying this. There are people, including medical doctors or functional medicine experts or nutritionists, they'll give you a blood test. They'll look at some of your levels of nutrients, say, hey, you know, let's get you in here because this is where you should be for optimal health. Could you share anything about what we truly know about what's optimal regarding specific nutrients?
I think our knowledge of, you know, the difference between and the recommended dietary allowances and dietary guidelines for a long, long time, probably up until about 15 to 20 years ago, were really written in the post-war era to prevent deficiency. And so we wanted to eliminate deficiencies of vitamin D, which led to scurvy, deficiencies in vitamin C, which led to scurvy, deficiencies in vitamin D, which led to rickets. And, you know, what is the minimal intake of nutrient X, Y, et cetera, to prevent that deficiency? And that's a fine and laudable goal. And I certainly subscribe to that, particularly if we were looking at kids that are growing, you know, we want to give them the best chances. So they need to have the right amount of zinc, need to have the right amount of iron, all of these vitamins, et cetera. And then in adulthood, you know, things change and you're not growing anymore. And it's really about prevention, I think, in your sort of mid-20s and beyond, prevention of decline. And so I sort of look at it a little bit differently to say is, what can we do to optimize that system to keep it functioning as if you were still a 20-year-old? Physically, I can tell you that my body doesn't work like it did when I was in my 20s. I have to be more careful about what I eat. But I think that the key part to me then is around trying to determine this sort of not just prevention of deficiency, but the optimal level. And that's much, much harder. Vitamin D, you brought it up as a great example. Michael Hollick is probably the most well-known proponent of, you know, very large doses of vitamin D. And then other people have sort of said, well, you probably need less. And other people have said, no, there's no toxicity and everything. I think the majority of people now would arrive at the conclusion that prevention of deficiency is good. Prevention of what's called insufficiency of vitamin D is also good. And then what is optimal is now, you know, the debate. If you opened my medicine cabinet and you looked at the things that I take supplements of, it would be vitamin D. Particularly, I live in a northern latitude in Canada where we get about 4 months of sunshine, where if I go outside, I can actually make some vitamin D. And, you know, it's September 11th and the window's closing faster. And so I take it in the winter. And I take omega-3 fish oil. And that's another one. I don't eat a lot of fish, probably not enough to get the benefits of it, and probably not only cardiovascular-wise, but maybe cognitively as well. And that's it. After that, I try and get everything from food as much as I can. But the optimal level is very difficult to pinpoint. I want to say that I think, and not to paint with a very broad brush, but the direct-to-consumer tests that purport to take a blood sample and then say you need this, this, and this, and this, and this, are at this time anyway, pretty inaccurate. And I don't know that I would lean on those too much. So I think that we've got some general ideas, but I certainly respect that some people have some very different ideas of that and would tell you we know what these things are. And, you know, protein is the one that we're most embroiled in. And certainly at 2 times the RDA, RDA being the prevention of deficiency level, I'm one that's arguing for, in the eyes of some people, supra physiological level. But I think the evidence for that is getting better, let's say. I don't know that the RDA will ever change, to be honest with you. I used to think it would, but I'm not sure that it ever will. So,
not in our lifetimes, huh?
No, I don't think so.
That's funny.
Unfortunately.
Even if we live to 120.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And just to go over that again, if you do want to dial something in, getting the adequate protein, you said the RDA is 0.8 grams per kilo, and you have found in your lab 1.6 grams per kilo. Is really like that. What would you call that? The minimum amount, the optimal amount?
That to me is the sweet spot. That's where you reap all the benefits in terms of, you know, the repair that you require after physical activity. but you also support all of the physiological functions that require amino acids in your body. And obviously, people want to focus on muscle because that's the big reservoir. But I'm talking about immune function. I'm talking about gut function. I'm talking about gut health, brain health, all these sorts of things. When you begin to choose more of those protein-based sources from animal foods, you get then the nutrient package along with them that you probably need. And a lot of people out there, I could cite, would argue in the opposite direction and say you should minimize protein intake and you should only eat the minimum amount. And, the debate rages on. It's always interesting. It's always fun, for sure.
Yeah. Are you referring to the mTOR activation or the quote unquote imbalance or imbalance of methionine to glycine?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of arguments, right? The one that you usually, the traditional sort of, I call them med school arguments, is that protein acidifies your blood and then the acids, leach calcium out of your bones. So actually protein causes your bones to get weak. We've got good meta-analysis evidence to say that's not the case now. In fact, calcium, vitamin D, and protein are bone supportive nutrients. I think, and it's a news flash for a lot of people, I say, your bones are 40% by content, they're collagen protein. And people go, wow, really? And I'm like, yeah, they're not just sticks of chalk, or they break all the time. They're flexible. They bend a little bit, not a lot, but just enough that you don't break them all the time. And then the next one is protein causes, and I always put that in quotation marks, renal failure. And I think the evidence, for that is decidedly lacking. But it's a 40, 50-year-old hypothesis. It's been out there, and it takes a lot of work to try and, budge that off of the med school curriculum, because mainly the observation is that people with chronic kidney disease or renal failure are on lower protein diets, and that prolongs their survival. But the circular logic is, and therefore, protein caused. And I'm like, no, you can't backtrack because and say one caused the other anyway. And then the last one is the more sort of, as you mentioned, up-to-date, and I'll call it, say, sophisticated evidence to show that the chronic activation of mTOR is probably not a good thing, and that's a protein-mediated mechanism. IGF-1 is in there in the mix, methionine and methionine restriction. So we had a little discussion thread on Twitter yesterday, and it was interesting to really, and I firmly believe this, that even if you have primate data around caloric restriction, so we're talking about monkeys in cages and everything, and people show that, calorically restricting these animals helps them live longer and everything else like that, is that the environment in which humans live is just so dissimilar from an animal in a cage. And it doesn't matter whether you're a fruit fly, a mouse, or a monkey. And this pandemic has revealed, at least to me, that for humans, it's really dealing, particularly as you get older, with these catabolic crises, and they're crises of hospitalization, bed rest or inactivity of some form or another, and a challenge to your immune function. And, those are the watershed events in an older person's life that they have a very hard time recovering from. When you're young, you get sick, you break a leg, you do whatever, you spend some time in hospital, you bounce back, you sort of have this little valley, and then you come back. When you're older, the valley goes down, and man, it is hard to get back. And so I think that we have to begin to think about aging in terms of those, catabolic crises. And I borrow that term from a good friend and colleague, Doug Padden-Jones, and hospitalization events, knee replacements, bouts of the flu. And now, we have a model where we make older people, and it sounds awful, I know, we make them only take 1,500 steps a day for a couple of weeks. And people said, oh, well, when do people really do that? And I don't know whether people have been wearing pedometers during this pandemic, but if you sit inside, and this is my office, and it's only 8 steps to my to get a coffee, whereas I used to have to walk a quarter mile and back, you probably take about 1,500 steps in a given day. So now we're all living it. And I know a lot of people are fond of saying, well, I look outside my window, I see people on bikes. And I'm like, well, you're at home now, so you can see them. So there's a little bit of observer bias. But the data from Fitbits and Garmins that we've looked at on a worldwide basis shows that people are doing a lot less. And so we think it's sort of a global, almost abrupt inactivity project. And older people who do this for 2 weeks, this is healthy older people, after 2 weeks become mildly insulin resistant. They're shifting towards a state of type 2 diabetes. And with 2 weeks of resumption of activity, they have a hard time getting it back. And with younger people, that's not the case.
Hold on for a second. When you say, okay, so they become, so healthy people who become sedentary for, say, 2 weeks and get that 1,500-ish steps in, develop some mild insulin resistance. And when you're saying bouncing back from that, you're not talking about, oh man, it's hard to get moving again. You're talking about metabolically, that their body metabolically is struggling to get out of the mild insulin resistance that they've developed. And so you wouldn't even know that this is happening unless you would measure it.
Yeah. You'd have no idea. So you're a 10,000 step a day person. You're following, 10,000 steps. I know it's a made up number, but it's always the goal steps. And then for 2 weeks, something happens. And we always used to say, it's not a Canadian phenomenon, but you have a nasty winter, you catch the flu, maybe you get respiratory symptoms, you go into the hospital, you're in the hospital for 3 to 4 days. Obviously, they give you the oxygen, they sort of give you fluids, they get you over the flu, you're well, in quotation marks, to leave the hospital. But then you spend 2 weeks, say, convalescing at home, and you're effectively housebound because it's, it doesn't matter if it's Fahrenheit or Celsius, but it's damn cold outside and the snow's, 6 to 8 inches deep and you don't want to have a fall and, it doesn't look very inviting. And so, this is it's a prolonged period of inactivity. You're still recovering from the sickness. And so that's what our model was designed to develop or recapitulate, I should say. And so 1,500 steps a day for 2 weeks. And then, let's say you feel good and you start getting outside and you shovel the driveway, you do all the things that you do. And my point is 2 weeks later, you're still not back to where you were before you had that bout of inactivity. That's in an older, healthy person. Now, layer sickness on top of that, layer chronic diseases on top of that, then you're talking about, events which for an older person, metabolically, they just have to dig themselves. It's a deep hole, and it's difficult to recover. So those are the events that are watershed events for an older person, where I think that a lot of the message around the higher protein and physical activity that we're pushing deeply distinguish what humans do from, you name any lab animal kept in a metabolic cage, restricted methionine or anything else like that.
Yeah, and just to kind of summarize what you said there, basically, there are people who are arguing, hey, don't eat too much protein because it triggers mTOR and IGF-1, and there might be some, it might trigger or exacerbate some precancerous something or another and mess you up. But what we're really finding is the issue is that there's these moments that happen to us in our lives as human beings, as sedentary modern people, like my dad is a great example. He's living what you're talking about, unfortunately. And he was struggling, but not doing a lot. Should have done physical therapy, could have done physical therapy, could have been more active, but he was like, hey, I'm doing all right. And ended up having some issues, ended up in the hospital for 2 weeks, lost massive muscle mass, and it destroyed him physically. It destroyed him psychologically. And he's suffering from these issues now that they were kind of bad before, but now they're really bad because he was bedridden for 2 weeks. And now it's, he just had surgery yesterday. And I don't think people understand what you're talking about that much. They're so focused on these things that don't really happen that much versus these things that, hey, listen, you're going to get the flu. You're going to be laid up in bed. You're going to develop this mild insulin resistance unless you work really freaking hard Like I got dengue fever in Thailand in 2019. I lost 6 pounds. People would say, "Oh, that's awesome! I'm going to fly to Thailand just to get stung by a bit by a mosquito so I can lose 6 pounds." But what it was is, I mean, some of it may have been fat mass, but it was mostly lean mass because I could barely get out of bed, and it took me weeks. And I'm very knowledgeable, highly motivated to get back. I'm like, oh, I'm going to get back my muscle. It took me, I want to say, a couple months to do it. And late 30s, no issues, right? But people who don't have the knowledge and the motivation that I have, they would have been just lower down a level in terms of their physical activity. Never going to get it back because you go into the gym. Oh my God, I'm weak. This, I can't do the thing. I can't walk fast. I can't run. I can't. I mean, my physical ability was several levels down. And I mean, I know what to do. I was eating, 0.8 grams of protein per pound. I go a little higher than your optimal recommendation for building muscle mass. But I was using high frequency training and combining and now I'm in great shape again. But for people who don't have that, they get knocked on their butts. It's like, and that was me when I was in my 30s. People are going to get the coronavirus or the flu, and it's going to be a thing that recurs. And so what you're saying, I know this. I was going to make it a short one, but. But what you're saying is these are the things that will really trash your life moving forward.
Yeah. One of the questions and your example and, you know, if your dad is not atypical, my father, I'm proud to say, it's as long as 15 years ago, he wasn't in great shape. I was really bugging him. I was right on his case to say he needed to come in to Pace. It wasn't Pace then, the center I direct, but I said, you know, Dad, you should really come in and these people know what they're doing and they'll give you a program that's really, and you know, he was, oh, you know, so one of the first things he did was to go get a stress test. And, you know, this is one of these things where, you know, it revealed that he had poor cardiovascular circulation and he went in and had a quadruple bypass. And so that probably saved his life. He was on the edge of, you know, a major heart attack, but not everybody gets the stress test, right? So there's these silent sort of factors that are going on. He probably had angina that he had chalked up to, you know, the muscles in his back kind of hurt when he did something. And, you know, like your dad, it's one of those things where you're like, I'm doing okay. And so since then, he's been a PACE member. He did his cardiac rehab in the center, and then he's never left. But during this pandemic, him and my mom, I said, you know, you guys need to be really careful because you're in a high risk group, et cetera, et cetera. And you can see that they've, their physical activity levels and their ability to get around it's been compromised. And so as knowledgeable as, folks like yourself and myself are, and we would fight to try and dig ourselves out of that. I think the majority of, mere mortals, normal people would not have either the knowledge or the foresight or be encouraged, and I'm sad to say this, by medical people to be physically active. You know, the message early on was stay home. And I don't disagree with that, but nobody ever said you can't go for a walk outside. And, you know, we talked about guidelines and doses of physical activity, and I always point out to people that the biggest reduction in risk comes when you take someone who does nothing to getting them to do something on a regular basis. And that could be as little as a 10-minute walk per day. And, you know, after that, it's, you know, the curve drops steeply and then it sort of begins to flatten out. Sure, you and I are probably somewhere out here. We do the, you know, 150 minutes might be, that's the buy-in level, but that's not what most people do. So think about people in their 50s and 60s and beyond who are, you can say healthy, but I can tell you we conduct studies where we screen lots of older people, and every now and again we talk about it and we call them these freaks that come in. They're in their 60s, 70s, and we say, what medications are you taking? And they say, none. And we just about fall over because it's so uncommon to see that now. So lots of people have chronic issues that are going to be exacerbated by these periods, and those are watershed moments for older folks. So your summary is spot on. I think you've really got to, you know, rail and try and dig yourself out of those things.
Let's dive into the recommendations. You already mentioned the 150 minutes of moderate physical activity a week. That's the guideline. One thing that you said that I think bears repeating is like, a lot of people, and I had this in my head, oh, if I'm not going to go to the gym for an hour or at least 30 minutes or 45 minutes or, you know, these arbitrary numbers, it's really not worth doing anything because, hey, it's not going to be a good workout. And what you said is just anything is better than nothing. And it's something that I've been preaching for a while. It's like, just do something, right? No matter what it is. You can drop and do push-ups, or can't do push-ups, do a plank hold, or, you know, your legs, do some squats, go for a walk, walk in place, do actually what I do. There's another Canadian friend of mine, Brad Thorpe, who's really into isometrics training, and do you know Brad?
Yeah, I know the name. Yeah, I know who he is. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. And I try to get for people who can't do steps or they're, you know, doing isometric holds that just challenge the muscle. And it's, you know, it can be a real game changer, not just to get in that work for the muscle when you don't have a lot of space, but also for your health and for your joints. So what do we know about, other than what the government guidelines for the 150 minutes, what do we know about what's optimal for longevity? Like, is there a point of diminishing returns that we're aware of?
Yeah, I mean, this is all sort of predicated and wrapped up in guidelines, which I think, you know, the evidence for which everybody has to admit is observational. It's the same for dietary guidelines. We have small randomized controlled trials where we can show improvements in people in short-term experiments. And, you know, people say, what does short-term mean? I'm saying, you know, weeks to months to, on the occasion, maybe year or maybe 2 years at the outside. So, you know, from that sense, there are levels of evidence that allow me to say, you know what, I think 150 minutes a week is reasonable. And we can probably estimate based on observational data where people who report, and by self-report, I'll admit, which I always think is an over-exaggeration, or like dietary guidance, everybody says, oh, we're collecting food frequency questionnaires. And I'm like, that's a, you know, maybe when you've got 50,000 people, it becomes like, yeah, I know which way the wind's blowing, but on an individual level, it's not particularly accurate. But, you know, glossing over some of those sort of assumptions, I mean, I think that it's pretty good evidence to say that if you've got 150 minutes of moderate, so, you know, reasonably intense walking that gets your heart rate up, you're going to be great. You're going to do really well. But even if you can only get 20 minutes, 10 minutes, 15, you know, those are the numbers that, to your point about, you know, it's only a worthwhile workout if you go to the gym, sweat to the degree that you soak, you know, right through whatever it is you're wearing, and you're absolutely exhausted at the end. And that's not true. That's, if you do that, that's great. And you can handle that and that you enjoy that, that's great. You know, people say, what's the best activity? And I'm still firm on this. The best activity is the one that you enjoy doing and that you'll keep doing. And I've softened on my position a lot on that over the years. And I think it comes from looking not just at the gym and your world, where I think a lot of people who want to say, well, you got to do this workout or, you know, you're wasting your time, is to take a broader look and take a stroll around and really begin to think about people that aren't like you and I or people at the gym and just normal people and say, what do these people need to do to improve their health? Is there better outcomes with more exercise? Probably so. Is there a point at which returns diminish? Absolutely. Where that point exists, I think, is probably pretty personal and individualized. As a population guess, I'm not sure that I could really say. What we do know, though, is that on average, if you're a physically active person that meets those goals, you can expect to, on average now, enjoy about an extra 2.5 years of life. What you can certainly expect if you follow the guidelines, and resistance exercise being part of that, and you know, that's a whole nother conversation. Usually they're an add-on, right? It's the do 150 minutes and it would be good. And I'm like, no. It wouldn't just be good. It would be excellent. And then they're required. And I think we're beginning to scratch away at the knowledge base there to have that recommendation become part of the 150 minutes and, two bouts of resistive work a week at least. But that's the one that people miss more often than not, and definitely don't make. Again, if self-report is any guide, you probably got about 15 to 20% of people doing that on a regular basis. So I'm going to cut that in half and just say that that's the number of people who I think are really doing it. But health span is the key, and I think that that's the big thing. So as I said, if I'm going to plan to live to be 95, which isn't an unreasonable goal by any stretch these days, I'd like to live to 95 and be in good health, go to sleep one day, and then never wake up, and that would be a life well lived in my books.
Yeah, thanks for sharing that. And it is a bit tough to figure out, and there's guidelines, and then there's other people saying things, and then there's, I can think of some research that was looking into I can't remember all the details, but looking into whether athletes live longer than the average active person. And the only people who live longer were, if I remember correctly, were endurance athletes.
Yeah.
Is that true to your knowledge, or?
Yeah. I think that there's a lot that confounds that. But I mean, one of the things that we've tried to hit on in the last few years, we had a symposium at the American College of Sports Medicine, and one of the talks that I gave was, a lot of the evidence in the United States and worldwide that for the prescription of physical activity as a bona fide way to reduce your risk comes from the Cooper Longitudinal Aerobic Study. And Ken Cooper, the main physician that was, to which, from his name is given to the study, is a runner, or, and still is. And so I sort of mused to say that if Ken Cooper was a weightlifter as opposed to a runner, we'd know a lot more about what weightlifting did for people's health than we would about aerobics. So we haven't got that study on a weightlifting aspect. And I think that it's tempting to look at people who are, were lifetime power lifters, which is a very different sort of sport to compete in than would be endurance activities, and some of those people, musculoskeletally later in life, they're not in great shape, and so that's maybe not the way that you should do things. So, I think from a prescriptive standpoint, and this is my personal belief, that beyond the age of 65, the thing that will stand you in better stead in terms of being able to do all the things that you want to do is to be strong. Not that being fit, cardiovascularly fit, is a poor thing, but it's the people who maximize both of those things. So, my colleague at McMaster University, Marty Gabala, convinced me through the work that he's done about high intensity type training that, if I only have 20 minutes, I can get a very effective workout in to, sort of alleviate my risk for all kinds of things and also keep my fitness level up. But I spend more time lifting now and less time doing long, slow runs and long, slow bike rides than I ever have. And I think that that's because being stronger as you get older is a better trait to have than being fitter.
Mm. Thanks for sharing that. One other thing before I'll let you go if you can. This is something I've been doing my best to promote, is the the biopsycho, what's kind of clunkily called the biopsychosocial model of health, right? I just kind of call it deep health, right? Because it sounds, rolls off the tongue a bit better, sounds cooler. But the biological is where most of us focus. Oh, how much exercise do I have? Should I eat the Japanese purple potatoes? Should I have the kale shakes? Should I take the NAD supplements? Should I do saunas? Should I, you know, the list goes on and on. What type of resistance training should I do, right? When we get to the psychological part, people are like, yeah, no, I'm, you know, whatever. Yeah, I'm good. You know, don't really pay it much thought. Although maybe the pandemic is helping people. I've seen that Talkspace, which is a therapy app, actually where I hired my therapist before the pandemic, but the use of it was up like 60%. Which is good to see. But the part that you brought up is the social aspect. So maybe you can clarify this. Okay, it's cool. So it seems to be working. You can clarify this, not just for the listeners, but for me as well, is that the social aspect is a big deal. Maybe even, I don't want to say equally important, because sitting on your butt and overeating and but having great relationships, right? It's kind of hard for me to see how that would pan out well, just from the beneficial social relationships. But what we know is that feelings of loneliness increase inflammation, and social isolation itself, which is actually being alone, can influence inflammation levels. Can you talk about that, what we know, what's important, and why people should pay more attention to this aspect of their life?
Yeah, I full disclosure is that I don't know very much about this, but I'm learning. What I do know is that, as you said, you know, people who are socially isolated, and this pandemic has probably driven that number up, particularly older people. The stereotypical is the older man, older woman who lives alone in an apartment, maybe has poor mobility and so has a hard time getting out, getting around, to the point where they might only see one person in a day. It may only be somebody who delivers a meal service or a medical facility or something like that that's doing something for these people. And, you know, that aspect of aging and the loneliness that people feel, as you said, is associated with inflammatory conditions and exacerbation of chronic health problems, and definitely mental health problems around anxiety, depression, etc., that really do affect people's quality of life, and likely then have an impact on the physiology and not only their quality of life, but maybe even the length of their life, and definitely their health span. So, you know, we're beginning to appreciate that people need to remain socially connected. That could be family. It could be faith-based. It could be through a group in terms of, other seniors. It could be with one or two special people, not necessarily relatives, even care workers, for example. But I think the biggest thing is for older folks to feel like there's a sense of purpose to their life. Linda Fried, who is probably the person who's done more to help define what we call frailty, has a program in which older people are asked to connect with younger people and engage in a little bit of sort of volunteerism even. And that's made a lot of these people, in terms of the perception of what they bring to the game, in terms of their value, if you like, feel a whole lot better. And then we notice that their anxiety goes down, their depression rate goes down, and they just feel better. So I think that we're beginning to, again, scrape the surface of this science, where we understand the connection between psychological, sociological, and then obviously physiological health. But I think as you get older, this probably underpins a lot of statistics around people who are married and have couples, live longer, men, I don't know, a lot of men say, well, it's because my wife bugged me to go to the doctor, because, you know, a lot of men just don't do it. Well, if that's the case, that's fine. But I mean, the social support that you get from your spouse or your partner, no matter who they are, if you feel that you're connected to them, that's a really big deal. And so we've got lots of data. Again, it's association, but I think we're beginning to pull apart some of these relationships, as you said, the inflammatory aspect. If you'd asked me about that 10 years ago, I'd have been like, nah, I just don't see it. But now it's beginning to go, wow, that's there. And, you know, how is that working? And so what's going on neurally? And I think that as a science, as long as neurological examination and everything has been around, we just don't have the right tools to be able to know what is happening, you know, until somebody dies, and then we can look at their brain. But, you know, in vivo brain imaging methodologies and lots of other things are beginning to show that this is a big deal. So I often like to say the stool on which good aging sits has three legs, and the three legs are, you know, physical activity, good nutrition, and then social connectivity and a sense of purpose in life. And, you know, one of those legs is a little bit wobbly. The stool is hard to sit on. And if you've only got one, then, you know, you really, the stool's going to fall over.
Yeah. Great point. And it's worth looking into your life and saying, how are so I'm exercising a lot, I'm eating the superfoods, even though not really even sure if that's going to help me or not, but I'm making good food choices in general. But being more intentional, I had a great conversation with a client the other day, and he was talking about an experience he had with this individual. He was with his sons, but he was camping in Yellowstone Park, and he had this great time, great conversation. But for him, it was something that just happened, and then it just happened by fluke. And what I said is, why not? If you work out every day, you do cardio every day, you do strength training multiple times a week, why not be more intentional about meeting those types of people, connecting with them, going out of your way to create that and taking it as serious, or at least, you know, close to as serious as you do your exercise and, you know, with your nutrition. And that's what I personally try to do now. And I just hung out with a friend of mine who is visiting. I'm in Playa del Carmen, Mexico right now. I made time for it.
Yeah.
I put things aside and made time for it. Now I'm single. I don't have kids. So, you know, if you're getting a lot of that from your partner, from your children, okay. But for those, but make sure you get it no matter what. And like, as you said, Stu, it's becoming something that 10 years ago, you'd have been like, that sounds kind of hokey, woo-woo, kind of dumb, actually. Just go lift weights, do some cardio, eat some kale, and shut up, you know?
Yeah.
But now we're learning. This is something about the social connectivity between us. It affects our brain, affects levels of neurotransmitters, which affects physiology, affects inflammation. So perhaps if you're looking to lower inflammation and you're already eating all the blueberries and the kale and you're exercising, maybe it's a different area of your life that you need to maybe address or look into. So Stu, just great connecting with you today. Thanks so much for taking the time out to share your knowledge and your wisdom. If you want to connect with Stu, I will have all these links, but he's on Twitter and Instagram at MacInProf. So that's, I'm going to spell that for you. It's at MacInProf. So at MacInProf. You can find him on Twitter and Instagram. He's also on LinkedIn and Facebook. I will have those links on the show notes for this episode. Stu, do you have any final words that you like to share for the listeners?
Well, I'd like to say thanks. I mean, I think it's a great opportunity. I always love being on these podcasts and trying to, you know, have a conversation. I call it the elevator pitch, although it's an hour long, but trying to translate some of what we know about how to age well. So I hope your listeners were able to glean a few nuggets in there that they can take away. So thanks for having me on the show. Much appreciated.
Thank you. And looking forward to getting you back on and diving into the hours of things that we didn't get a chance to talk about today.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you.
That wraps up another episode of the Legendary Life Podcast. I hope you enjoyed this one. And I want to ask you, what is your biggest takeaway from listening to Dr. Phillips today? What will you take away from this podcast? And what will you do differently in your life? That's what I want you to think about, because information is nice, but we're not just here so that we can sound more interesting in a cocktail party, are we? We're here because we want to live life on that next level. And the way to get there is through taking action. So I want to ask you again, what was your big takeaway or your top two or three takeaways? And what will you do differently after listening to this episode? That's what I want you to take away from today. That's what I want to leave you with. And again, if you have not subscribed to our podcast, what are you waiting for? We've got episodes like this coming out all the time. I don't want you to miss them. I want to tell you something. I get asked by so many people to come on my show. I turn 99% of them down. Why? Because this show is curated. I don't let just anybody come on this show. I only let the best of the best of the best. And if you haven't heard someone on here, I don't think they're that great. I think they're more marketing. I don't need to say any more than that, but I have the real deal people, the guy like Stuart Phillips, who's authored 300 papers, research papers on human physiology, nutrition, and aging. That's the type of caliber of people that we have on this show. Not the best marketing, not who has the biggest following, not who has the biggest email list, not who has the biggest IG following or Facebook friends. It is the best of the best on this show. So if that's what you're interested in, make sure you go to legendarylifepodcast.com/review to learn how to subscribe. And eventually, if you are appreciating the show, we'd love to hear from you, hear your review, and for you to give us a review is what I should say. Again, that's legendarylifepodcast.com/review. All right, that's all I've got for today. Hope you enjoyed this one. Got so much coming for you. Can't wait. And I will speak to you on Friday. Have a great week and speak to you then.